There's a book which I think many of you are familiar with, Divided by Faith. And in that book, Christian Smith and Michael Emerson designate John Perkins as one of the founding fathers of the reconciliation movement in evangelical Christianity. And he is named as one of three black evangelical leaders who formed what I would call a reconciliation triumvirate. And those three men are Tom Skinner, Sam Hines, and John Perkins. And so as I address my topic, which is John Perkins and the social witness of the African American church, I want to begin by just kind of locating Dr. Perkins within this sort of reconciliation movement. Tom Skinner was from New York, Sam Hines was from Jamaica by way of Washington, D.C., and John Perkins, as you know, was from Mississippi. They were three prominent black leaders who participated in what Smith and Emerson regard as a failed experiment to convince white evangelicals to practice reconciliation. Skinner was the evangelist. Hines was the pastor. And Perkins, as we know, was the witness, the storyteller, the Bible teacher, the community organizer. And he is the only one of the three who survives and continues to thrive in reconciliation ministry. Tom died in his 50s. Sam Hines died at the age of 65. And in both cases, I think we can say they died prematurely. But all the more reason to be thankful for the fruitful longevity of John Perkins, because he has lived long enough, I think, to hopefully outlive the verdict of Smith and Emerson that the reconciliation movement has indeed failed. I knew all three of these men, and I knew Dr. Hines the best because he was my pastor for 25 years. And I succeeded him when I assumed the pastoral leadership of the Third Street Church of God. I knew Tom Skinner to be a gifted evangelist, one of a few preachers I've ever known who can hold an audience for 2.5 hours. I mean, preaching, and people at the edge of their seats, as opposed to falling off of their seats or vacating their seat. So he had a gift. And he addressed the claims of the gospel of Jesus Christ in evangelistic crusades and conventions. And he specifically addressed the relevance of the gospel to the call to black power and liberation. His testimony was that he had been a gang member, a gang banger, and he had a conversion experience, and he preached the gospel out of that journey. Dr. Hines brought preaching and pastoral care to the work of reconciliation in the context of the local congregation. And he excelled. He was also an excellent exegetical preacher, but he also excelled in forging relationships and acquiring resources to support urban ministry partnerships. The hallmark of his ministry at Third Street was the Urban Prayer Breakfast, which was a daily program of ministry and outreach among the poor and homeless inhabitants of the streets of Washington, D.C. The church is located right in the center of the city. If you know anything about Washington, it's shaped like a diamond, and the Capitol is in the center, and we're about 1 mile north of the Capitol, so we're right in the middle of the city. And there, for about 25 years or more, we will have, from Monday through Friday, a breakfast outreach ministry, 7 a.m. There will be praise and worship. There'll be proclamation of the gospel. a call to discipleship that specifically reached out to the poor. Because the street population ministered to far exceeded the small membership of the congregation. Sometimes we had so many people, we would have the fellowship hall on the lower level filled with chairs, and then we would have the sanctuary full of people waiting to come down and be served. And on any given day, that's one thing I can commend honor the memory of President Ronald Reagan, because during the Reagan years, that was the high water mark of our ministry, because so many people were turned out of mental institutions and other places that had been their place of safety. They were turned out to the streets. So those were the years when we had the highest attendance. But often the people we fed, the number of people I commend him for that, because, you know, it was still a mystery to me why so many, he gets to be the hero of evangelical Christians. But that's one thing he contributed to our ministry, is to give us more people to have to feed by his policies. But we fed more people than we had members. And so the only way to do that is to enter into ministry partnerships. And so we were feeding so many people. I guess we fed 5,000 about every 3 weeks, if you want to measure it in those terms, a miracle. We didn't do it all in one day, but we could do it in about 2 or 3 weeks. We could feed 5,000. And so we had to have ministry partnerships in order to sustain the day-to-day tasks of preaching, leading worship, cooking, cleanup, security, all of that stuff. We had people from far and near who came. They saw what we were doing, and they would come and participate. And particularly, Pastor Hines began this ministry on the basis of a friendship. Dr. Perkins has spoken about an important first step, if you're serious about the ministry of reconciliation, is to befriend, to get into a friendship, a relationship, interpersonal relationship with someone in that other group. And so for him, it was Pastor Louis Evans, who died not too long ago. He was pastor of the National Presbyterian Church in Washington, which is, shall we say, on the other part of town. And Pastor Evans, to this day, the National Presbyterian Church remains a valued ministry partner in terms of volunteers and resources to support our outreach ministry. So at this point, we had to suspend the breakfast in the summer of 2007. It became too expensive, and it was really demanding of a limited number of volunteers, not to mention the fact that our church had undergone a renovation, and ever since our kitchen was torn out in 2003, and we're still trying to rebuild and expand to re-establish. So if you can imagine a church without a kitchen, that's who we are. So you're kind of hard-pressed to do this kind of ministry if you don't have a kitchen. We do have a full-time social worker on staff, and we have a drop-in center, a basement apartment in a townhouse that we own in the block. And so our social worker's salary is paid in part by National Presbyterian Church. And he is able to do support groups, Bible study referrals for the poor on a drop-in basis during the week. We also sponsor community dinners at Thanksgiving and Christmas with volunteers and contributions from a broad range of denominations and races coming together to celebrate the holidays with the homeless and with our neighbors who are housed in the community. Our latest endeavor is a Sunday morning community worship service, which we just started on Easter Sunday, a service that is from 8:30 a.m. to 9:30, 1 hour service, where we serve a light continental breakfast, coffee, fruit, and pastry. And we invite people to participate in the worship and listen and to respond to the preached word in a relaxed atmosphere. And so the work that Dr. Hines started at 3rd Street does continue as we are endeavoring still to make a difference in the community. The Tom Skinner legacy lives on in Washington. in the work of Barbara Williams Skinner. And Barbara is also an alumna of the School of Divinity. After Tom's death, she enrolled in the Master of Divinity program and went on to earn her Doctor of Ministry degree. And she runs the Skinner Leadership Foundation. Actually, she has an estate in near Solomon's Island, Tracy's Landing, I think is the name of the place, out from D.C. And but a significant campus ministry presence at Howard University, including a chaplain and a staff of assistants who are doing leadership development with Christian students at Howard. Now, I also wanted to mention a person who is whose story is told in the Divided by Faith book, and that is Curtis Paul DeYoung. He just released a new autobiography entitled Homecoming, A White Man's Journey Through Harlem to Jerusalem. And I just got it like about a week ago. But his story is told in Divided by Faith. And Curtis's sojourn includes an undergraduate degree from the Church of God University in Anderson, Indiana. My church is Church of God, parentheses, Anderson, Indiana. And that's where the general agencies and the university affiliated with our church is located. So Curtis was the son of a Church of God pastor. He did his undergraduate degree at Anderson. And he came to Washington to work in urban ministry under Pastor Hines. And while he was there, he decided to stay in Washington. And he, well, you can read his story. He fell in love with a young lady, I think the first Sunday that he came to church. And he decided he was not going back to Indiana. And so he transferred to Howard and did his Master of Divinity degree there and did his field education internship at Third Street Church of God. Curtis has written a number of books on reconciliation, and he has established a Department of Reconciliation Studies at Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he's professor of reconciliation studies. And I would just say that Curtis's emphasis, his focus, his stamina in this reconciliation ministry is largely credited to these three men, Skinner, Hines, and Perkins. As a focus for my presentation today, I'd like to speak about the impact John Perkins has had on the social witness of the African-American churches with respect to three specific concerns: prophetic ministry, the prosperity gospel, and gentrification. Those are three issues that I would like to address. I've been intentional about using the term churches rather than church. There's a book recently published, well, maybe 6 or 8 months ago, entitled Your Spirits Walk Among Us. The author is a historian at the University of Pennsylvania, Barbara Savage. And the subtitle of the book is Black Religion and Politics. And in that book, Barbara Savage makes a case for always referring to the Black or African American church in the plural, in deference to the diversity of traditions, practices, and denominations represented among Black Christian congregations. I agree with that. And one of the things that is an important emphasis in her book, she does an analysis of the, if you can go back almost to the day a year ago, when the Jeremiah Wright, Barack Obama controversy came to a head, almost exactly a year ago, at the National Press Club in Washington. And then the 2 days, there was a conference that followed Jeremiah Wright's National Press Club press conference. And he actually was at Howard Divinity School in the chapel when we got the word that Senator, at the time, Senator Obama had completely denounced and severed his ties with the Trinity United Church of Christ. We were right in the middle of that. But in her book, she addresses that controversy between Jeremiah Wright and Barack Obama, and is making the point that Jeremiah Wright even does not represent the black church in the singular, but that we need to think a little more broadly about the black church as scholars and just in general when we speak about who is included in the black church or who represents the black church or what's the voice of the black church or what kind of preaching goes on in the black church, which a year ago was newsworthy. And I'm not sure where it is now. Well, it will depend on where the president decides to go to church. And this is, we are already past Easter, and I think he's been to church like one, he's been to one black church one Sunday since he's been in Washington. And it's almost like it's going to be impossible. It may force him away from the black church because of what happened, and he may have to become an Episcopalian, which is good. That's good. Because there's an Episcopal church right across the street. No controversy. Don't have to vet the sermons, right, Charles? Right. So he's probably going to become Episcopalian. I want also to affirm the language I've heard from Dr. Perkins this week when he speaks of, I've heard him say this several times, the so-called black church. I don't know if you're paying attention, and I like that, so-called. It reminds me of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad back in the 1960s, who used to write and speak about the so-called Negroes. But what I hear from Dr. Perkins, and I wish he were here, he could tell me if this is right or wrong, but I suspect that what he's saying is that there's really no such thing as the black church or the white church, because the real church belongs to God. We bring ethnicity and culture and denomination and all these distinctives to our corporate Christian witness. But I'm not sure we want to privilege our race or color or culture or history as categories by which to name our churches. Should the church be named for the God who rules it or for the people in it? And who does the church belong to? To God, or again, to certain categories or groups or classes of people. So let me say a word about the prophetic ministry and the prosperity gospel and the gentrification, and then I will try to leave. We have until 2:30?
Yes.
Okay, and I'll try to make sure to leave time for discussion and questions. Prophetic ministry. By prophetic ministry, I mean the proclamation and implementation of the spoken word of God. That kind of assumes that the prophet has heard from God in order to speak. A prophet speaks for God what the prophet has heard from God. But prophetic ministry is not just proclamation, it's implementation. And certainly, John Perkins models this in his stories, his testimonies, his books, his life as a community organizer. The CCDA gatherings equip and empower and encourage people to do transformative prophetic ministries. And when people say, and I hear this all the time, but when people say that the black church is silent on the issues of the day, they are not hearing what John Perkins is saying every day. And I've already mentioned Jeremiah Wright. It's sort of like when the black church does speak, it's the wrong thing. But it's like it's one extreme. Either they're saying the wrong thing, they're cursing and saying all this terrible stuff about our nation, or they're saying nothing. And then all the rest of what the discourse that goes on in between goes unheard. But John Perkins implements, proclaims, illustrates prophetic ministry. Prosperity gospel. His own narrative of his ascent from poverty to purposeful prosperity has been focused on giving back and empowering others. I wrote a book back in 1995, Empowerment Ethics for Liberated People. It was my effort to give a constructive intellectual response to black theology. This is my constructive critique. As I didn't have time to write a book to say everything that was wrong with black theology. So I devoted maybe about 2 pages to what I saw as deficient in black theology, and then the whole rest of the book, well, this is what you can do to empower people who are liberated, because liberation is not enough. But where I end up in that book is to argue that you have not really helped or transformed an individual until that individual is positioned to give back. You can feed them, you can get them a job, you can get them a place to stay, you can get them to join your church, you can get them to have a life-changing encounter with Jesus Christ, but until they're given back, you haven't closed the loop. And so that ought to be our goal in our transformative ministries, that we empower people to give back. Now, as you have heard, Dr. Perkins is critical of black pastors and televangelists who wrongfully divide the word. See, the Bible says you're supposed to rightfully divide the word of truth. Well, they wrongfully, the word is still true, but they wrongfully divide it in terms that maximize profit rather than prophecy. And they promote consumerism over the cross. Prosperity, as you know, is biblical. And Perkins is correct in his condemnation of white and black evangelicals whose own endorsement of materialism and excess leaves them no leverage for addressing the current economic crisis, not to mention seeking understanding of its root causes. If you seek to analyze something, respond to something, you need to get at the root causes. But some of us as Christians can't get to the root causes because that mirror shines too. Then we see our own reflection in that mirror. And there's a mirror down there. When we're digging, there's a mirror, and we don't want to see that image in the mirror. So it's like, well, let's stop digging because we're gonna have to undermine our own value system in order to responsibly bring a critique on where we are and where we're headed. So prosperity gospel got to go. But I do think that, again, that I can show you all kinds of people who will give an intelligent critique of the prosperity gospel, but I also need you to show me the implementation of the alternative. Okay, we can agree. Prosperity gospel, we don't want that. But what are you doing with your wealth? How are you reinvesting? How do you go about doing that? And I think we get that from John Perkins, and I thank him for that. Then thirdly and finally, I want to say a word about gentrification. That's my address at Third Street Church of God. We are on Gentrification Boulevard. If you know the city of Washington, you probably heard, well, I know you, everybody heard of Capitol Hill. That's where the Capitol is. It's kind of on a hill. And you, as you expect, the senators and the Congress people and the lobbyists and, you know, people have nice condos and row houses and things in the area. It's not really a huge residential area because there's a lot of federal buildings there. But people who live in close proximity to the Capitol, you expect that to be, you know, kind of Tony kind of area. Georgetown is in the far... if you go directly west, all the way to the edge, the far west edge of the city, Georgetown is a neighborhood, again, has a reputation being very affluent, shops. If the president does go, any of the presidents for that matter, if they go Christmas shopping, see, in Washington, we are obsessed with media coverage of president. So if the president goes to buy a Christmas gift, it's like a press event. Well, the president's going to go to Georgetown to, you know, to get some nice gift for his wife in the boutique in Georgetown. But 50 years ago, Georgetown was a ghetto. And that history, in other words, is where black people live. And today, the only vestige that is left of a black presence in Georgetown are a few little black churches. And those churches are kind of like, they're just kind of barely hanging on. But other than those churches, Georgetown has completely, completely and totally gentrified to the point where even the memory is erased. So Georgetown, the gentrification moved from Georgetown. The next area is called DuPont Circle, moving east, and Logan Circle. And then you got, I wish I had a map. Then you got Capitol Hill. And the last thing, space in the corridor from Capitol Hill to Georgetown that would prevent it from being an unbroken corridor of gentrification is Shaw. And that's the community in which we live. And Shaw is rapidly gentrifying. And so once the Shaw community becomes completely gentrified, then it's going to be a pretty solid corridor. What does that mean? Where do those people who are renters, for the most part, where do they go? Well, they go to the suburbs or they go to some other neighborhood, but they're not going to be able to afford to stay in this neighborhood. While we commend the notions of relocation, redistribution, and reconciliation, as we ought to do, because of where I sit as pastor of a small holiness congregation in a rapidly changing neighborhood in the center of the city, I must ask myself the question, what entitles anyone to relocate to our neighborhood? I just have to ask that for anybody. What entitles, if you're white, if you're Asian, if you're black, what entitles you to relocate yourself to our neighborhood? The most obvious manifestation of transformation in the Shaw community, where we're located, is the renovation of row houses by the moneyed gentry. Gentrification is done by the gentry. The gentry are landowners, people who have the resources, who have the intelligence, who have the connections to buy property, renovate property, and fix it like they want it to be so that they can live in it. The affluent, highly educated, professionally employed, or comfortably retired, gay or straight couples and individuals who have decided that Shaw is a desirable place to live. So they purchase and rehab their houses. They all seem to have dogs and blogs. And they fight crime through the neighborhood associations. We have sort of, it's almost like the old days racial segregation. We have the white community association, we have the black community association. And I try to go to both of them. And community policing. What does it mean for a black congregation to be a good neighbor in a changing community? That's a question that I have to live with and wrestle with every day. How do we preach the gospel to affluent white people who don't think they need to hear about salvation? They don't need to be saved. And if they do, they certainly don't need to hear it from somebody who looks like me. What kind of good news do we have to offer to white people who move into our community? Can we speak their language? Can we comprehend their values? Can we reinvent ourselves as a church to meet their demands without offending their cultural and intellectual sensibilities? What does it mean to meet them as they are? That sounds real good. You know, when you're trying to evangelize people, don't you meet them as they are? Well, what does that mean when we're talking about white people? To meet them as they are. Do the principles of mutuality and reciprocity that we see demonstrated in Jesus' outreach to the Samaritan woman apply to them? I'm so glad that he mentioned it. I already had it in my notes, but Dr. Perkins spoke about, well, he read the first couple of verses of John chapter 4. But if you read on John chapter 4 about the Samaritan woman, and particularly the part where, you know, Jesus is tired and he's hungry, and the disciples go into town, and he sits at the well, right? And he asked the woman for a drink of water. I kind of wish the story would stop there, because what that shows you is, who was ministering to whom? He was the one that was thirsty, not her. And so the whole conversation grows out of him asking her. And I think for many of us, our mindset is, we're the ones that got the glass of water. And the people we're trying to minister to, we're trying to offer them our glass of water. But if you want to put yourself in a place of Jesus, which, you know, of course, we all want to do that, right? We want to be Jesus in the story. Then you're the one who's thirsty. And you're the one who's asking for an intervention. And so that's what I mean by the principle of mutuality and reciprocity. I think if you're going to relocate, if you're going to reconcile, if you're going to redistribute, you have to have a consciousness of mutuality and reciprocity, that those people you are helping are not your mission project, but they are people who have lives and aspirations, and they just might have the glass of water that you need. If you will acknowledge the mutuality in ministry. I have more to say about that in my book, Ministry at the Margins, which has been out of print for some time. But I'm hoping in the next month or so to have it republished by Whip and Stock Publishers. So it should be available on Amazon and other outlets. But I think that the Samaritan woman represents for me one way of answering all of these questions. I know I've raised more questions than I've given you answers, but that's why we're here, is to have conversation. You know, how do we make our way? The social impact on the black churches. I know for a fact that there are many black congregations in our city who've made the decision, we're just going to move to the suburbs. And in Washington, the move to the suburbs generally means a move to Prince George's County, because Prince George's County is home, maybe rivaled by the suburbs of Atlanta. It's home to the largest and the most affluent mega churches in the country are concentrated in Prince George's County. So it's like, well, let's forget about the city. Let's just go to the suburbs. But I have a ministry colleague who's attempted to do that and ended up congregationally homeless, because the financing failed on the new $31 million construction in the suburbs, and they sold their church in Logan, and so now they're just renting space in a school to worship. So it's a real crisis for us in the city. But for those of us who have decided that we're going to stay, and I didn't mention this, but our church has been located in that community since 1927. And so we have a longstanding presence in the community, and we have an ongoing commitment to be good neighbors in that community. I'm just trying to figure out, what does that mean given gentrification and the changing demographics of our city and so many other cities where these issues are brought to focus. I think I will stop there, and we'll turn it over to Charles.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sanders. Again.